Find people who challenge you to grow from a place of mutual respect, appreciation, and caring. Learning. The best way for your radiance to serve others is to challenge yourself to grow. To that end, make deliberate learning an ongoing focus of your life. Being intentional in your pursuit of knowledge will help you engage with the world and open it up in ways you would have never considered or been willing to otherwise. During your reflections, ask yourself, what am I learning? What lessons has, insert situation or relationship here, taught me or inspired me to learn? What do I want to know more about? How will I go about learning it? Whether it's reading, classes, conversations with trusted friends and mentors, or enriching experiences, make it part of your plans. Use your bullet journal to identify the things that inspire further inquiry. Once you know what grabs your interest, set your goals. You can tackle them the same way you would any other goal in your bullet journal. But in the PDF, I've also provided the following visual example of how to apply this approach directly to learning. With each thing you learn, you become a more capable, well-rounded, substantive individual. You'll add more value to anyone within your presence, not because of what you do for them, but because of what you've done to illuminate yourself. Endurance. If you know the why, you can live anyhow. Friedrich Nietzsche. I don't know about you, but I deeply hate doing the dishes. It's stupid, I know. I've tried to make it a mindfulness practice, a way to unplug, but no. It was my boyhood chore for years, and that soured the deed for the rest of time. My partner at the time wanted to learn how to cook. Developing that skill forced me to spend my nights begrudgingly bulldozing the ectoplasm off our kitchenware. And so it went. She would come home and quickly undo my culinary exorcism from the previous evening. Yes, I should have just been grateful that I was getting home-cooked meals, especially after she worked hard all day, but I petulantly resented spending my limited free time cleaning up meal after meal. All that changed one night when I heard her sing. She was going through a really hard time when she took up cooking. Her usually vibrant and charmingly goofy personality, which had drawn me to her in the first place, was dialed way down. Our communication was usually strong, but whatever she was going through was something I couldn't help her with. Of course, that added to my frustration. After all, when the ones we love are in pain, the last thing we want to do is nothing. One night, before dinner, I was lifted from my work by a soft melody that floated through our flat. I didn't understand what was happening, as I had never heard her sing in the years we'd been together. But there she was, quietly singing and swaying by the stove, fixing us supper. That's when it dawned on me. This whole cooking thing had nothing to do with food at all. It was her way of battling her demons while still showing me how much she cared. It was something she could control. That night while I did the dishes, that peaceful image of her would not leave my mind. I realized that all I had to do to help her, all that I could do, was get my hands wet. As time went on, she got better. I began looking forward to her meals as she slowly eased back into her lovely old self. In fact, these dinners became a safe place that allowed us to deepen our relationship. When things got rocky and we needed to have a talk, one of us would cook a meal for the other. No matter how hard the conversation, it was always accompanied by this loving effort, a sign of deep respect and caring. That included doing the dishes, which, it turns out, was her least favorite thing to do too. Nothing deepens a relationship more than something you can hate together. Did all this make me enjoy doing the dishes? No, but it did allow me to see how it mattered. This seemingly menial chore that I had merely endured suddenly added real value to my life. What had changed? Not the pedestrian process of washing the dishes. Of course, what had changed was me. This task began to matter to me, and I tried harder. One day she walked by while I was cleaning up after the best meal I've ever enjoyed, and she kissed me on the cheek and said, "Thank you. I know it was a lot tonight, and that you hate doing this, but it really helps me. It makes me feel loved. When I used to think about defining and finding what mattered, what was truly meaningful to me, it seemed to require some dramatic gesture. Perhaps I'd have to pack my bags and seek out an enlightened cave dweller in a cold, remote corner of the earth. I know now that meaning can be found much closer to home. Meaning can reveal itself in the most unremarkable, unpredictable, and quiet of moments. If we're not listening to the world around us, as well as the one within, we may miss it. The music in the mundane. This is a skill that can be acquired through study, but not of academics or anything beyond our ken. The subject of our study is our experience. Often we operate unconsciously. We make our way through life on autopilot, seldom stopping to understand why something makes us feel the way it does. Without personal context, without understanding how something adds value to your life, your efforts will ultimately feel meaningless. Context helps us understand how some unpleasant or even painful responsibilities actually benefit us. Let's explore some ways to surface context. In practice, clarity log. Sam Cawthorn, founder of Speakers Tribe, once said, "The happiest people don't necessarily have the best of everything, but they make the most of everything." A powerful way to begin this process is to reframe the mundane in our mind. Many tasks may not inspire much joy at first blush. Do the laundry, finish project, buy groceries, etc. Rather than focusing on the drudgery of the action, spend a moment focusing on the experiences they enable. Doing the laundry gives you fluffy towels after you shower, fresh shirts for your workday, and crisp sheets to slip between at night. Finishing a project gives you a feeling of satisfaction of a job well done and keeps that paycheck rolling in, maybe some of which is going towards your Hawaii vacation. Buying groceries will put a tasty meal on your table or allow you to spend some quality time with your loved ones. This is not about positive thinking. It's about systematically analyzing your efforts to define their purpose. We don't tend to contextualize our obligations this way. To help us become mindful of why we're doing what we're doing, we can create a clarity log in our bullet journal. Scan your daily logs and identify the obligations or chores that you struggle with the most. Take one and write it down on the left page of your clarity log. Let's take paying rent, for example. Paying rent bums me out because it feels like a waste of money. Sure, it's easy to look at paying rent as the monthly ritual where you shovel your hard-won living into the icy void where your landlord's soul should be. But surely there was a reason you rented that place. Let's balance our negative perception of this obligation by taking a moment to focus on what you enjoy about your home. Close your eyes and conjure a detail or two about what keeps you there. What makes this space a home? Whatever it is, write it on the facing page across from the challenge. For example, note, the way the shaft of light warms the floor by the bed in the morning. Note, the fragrance of the coffee shop wafting in through the windows. Note, the commute time. No place is perfect, but if you're mostly happy with your home, then paying rent can be reframed as the act of rewarding yourself every month with those joys. It clarifies why this seeming chore is meaningful. Another way to discover personal meaning is to consider those we love. Perhaps this exercise made you realize that you truly don't like your home. If so, I apologize. I've been there. Not all is lost. Think about why you moved there through the lens of your relationships. Maybe this home allowed your kids to go to a better school. Maybe it allowed you to be closer to work, so you would spend less time commuting and more time with friends. Whatever it was, write it down. Connecting your obligations to the people you love can inject them with much-needed meaning. While it may not make these responsibilities any more enjoyable, it does finally give them purpose, which can make even the most onerous task more bearable. I've provided a visual example of a clarity log in the bonus PDF. Track progress. What if you tried this exercise but failed to find the benefit or meaning underlying some obligation? Many things we do don't immediately reveal their value. Meaning, much like a terrible guest, often arrives late, bearing a great bottle of wine. Observant patience is the key. If you're failing to find the purpose of a particular pursuit, keep an eye on it. Monthly migration can also be used to monitor progress. Use it as a milestone to check in with yourself to see if anything has shifted. If you finally come to the conclusion that an obligation is adding no value to your life or that the effort far outweighs the value it provides, then you've identified a distraction. Let it go. If you can't let it go for whatever reason, deconstruct your obligation and figure out your alternatives. Deconstruction. What stands in the way becomes the way. Marcus Aurelius. One of the oldest texts known to us is the Enuma Elish. It's a Babylonian creation myth that pits Marduk, champion of the gods, against Tiamat, a dragon-like beast, mother to monsters, who is determined to destroy the gods. It depicts an epic battle to the death between good and evil, order and chaos. Marduk slays Tiamat and then proceeds to dismember her body, using the pieces to lay the foundation for all of creation. Her ribs become the sky, and her mouth becomes the ocean. Though a bit ghastly, it's a powerful metaphor for how we can deconstruct our challenges and use them to our advantage. When I graduated from college, I was fortunate to get the internship of my dreams. I double majored in graphic design and creative writing, and I wanted to combine these skills by working on title sequences. You know, those micro movies that bookend the actual film. The internship was working for a man who was pioneering the resurgence of this art form and whose work was greatly inspiring. I moved to New York with two bags and took up residence in a mildewy basement apartment I could hardly afford, with two roommates who had nabbed the good rooms and a jumpy cat I didn't see eye to eye with. It was a small price to pay for my new career. The week before I was scheduled to start, I called the office to get the final details about the internship. It turned out that because of the World Trade Center attacks the year before, the company had downsized. Long story short, I had been laid off before my first day, and no one had even bothered to tell me. Suddenly, I found myself just another unemployed art student in New York, searching for work in one of the bleakest job markets in recent history, during one of the harshest winters in decades. For many months, I looked fruitlessly for a job. My meager savings evaporated. On good days, I'd trudge through the snow, jam my portfolio into packed subway cars at rush hour, and thaw while being interviewed by a bored HR staffer for some job I was inevitably unqualified for. On bad days, I just sat in front of a computer applying for any job I could find. One morning, I woke up to a strange sound. I opened my eyes and noticed the floor was moving. No, the floor was underwater. The snow had melted overnight and had pooled in my bedroom. Floating by my bed was my portfolio, filled with my design work that I was using to apply for jobs. My first thought was, at least it's all backed up. That's when I saw my backup drive submerged on the floor and my computer flickering next to it. That morning, I lost nearly everything I owned. Shortly thereafter, I accepted the first job I was offered purely to survive. The job had nothing at all to do with my skill set, but I was broke and homeless. In my first week, I learned that my predecessors had all run away screaming, and it quickly dawned on me why. My main function was to compile backlist order forms, list of all the books that this company had published, hundreds of thousands of them. Yes, I'm into lists. But this was a special kind of hell even for me. There was no solid tech or system to facilitate this process, so inevitably something somewhere would go wrong and all inky fingers would point at me. On top of all this, I reported to a wildly abusive boss who systematically dismantled any confidence or self-worth I had. She screamed at me so loudly once that people from adjacent offices came running in because they thought there was a situation. It got to the point where I was actually afraid to go to work. I didn't know how, but something had to change. Once again, I started interviewing for any position I could find. It did not go well. The truth was, I had nothing to show for myself. My portfolio was gone. I had a few random summer internships worth of experience, and I was working a job mostly unrelated to my skill set. I wouldn't have hired me. I swallowed my pride and accepted the fact that I had to make myself more valuable. In my proto-bullet journal, I started mapping out how I was spending my free time. A fair amount of it was spent online. I started tracking what I was spending my time looking at and realized that I was reading and learning about interactive online experiences. There was a nascent movement of experimental websites mixing art, photography, video, and design into fascinating interactive narratives. It was also around the time that personal websites started popping up, especially for artists, designers, and small businesses. Still recovering from the flood, I could deeply appreciate the benefits of having my work online, far removed from the clutches of negligent landlords and wet acts of God. Also, it so happened that several friends had asked if I could build websites for them or the businesses they worked for. Perhaps there would be some money in it. I scraped together whatever remained of my laughable salary and started taking night classes in the then-new field of web design. A couple nights a week, I dragged myself into the windowless classroom, exhausted from my day job, but motivated. For the first time in a long time, I was working on something that resonated with me. I learned how to design and code rudimentary websites. I jumped at any opportunity that presented itself. First, I designed a site for a local restaurant, then another for the restaurant's bartender's band, and so on. Eventually, I was able to scrape up just enough freelance work to resign and fully focus on an entirely new career path. While I can't say I charted this path skillfully or even particularly willingly, the experience taught me that it's all too easy to start feeling as if we're being held hostage by our circumstances, be they taxes, paying rent, taking care of a sick family member, or paying off student loans. These are the dragons in our lives. We can cower in fear, rage against fate, play the martyr, wallow in self-pity, waiting for the skies to magically part and be rescued, or we can take up arms. In practice, we have a tendency to blow our problems way out of proportion. No matter how bad a problem really is, chances are we're making it much worse in our minds. It can feel all-consuming, making us believe we're powerless and helpless, but that's never true. No matter how bleak or menacing a situation may appear, it does not entirely own us. It can't take away our freedom to respond, our power to take action. Even the smallest action can start changing our circumstances. The first action can simply be pausing to examine your problem so you can begin to deconstruct it. To do this, we'll use a technique known as the five whys. The five whys. Sakichi Toyoda, founder of Toyota and father of the Japanese Industrial Revolution, invented this technique to uncover the causes of technical problems in his company's manufacturing process. It's a deceptively simple method to unearth root issues and expose unexpected opportunities. It does this by breaking down a seemingly large problem into its individual components. We can use the same approach for tackling our challenges using our bullet journals. Start with a collection and give it a topic that names the problem. I can't pay rent, for example. Now ask yourself why. Write down the answer. Now challenge your answer by asking why again. Do the same for the next answer and so on, up to five times. For example, I can't pay rent. 1. Why? Because I don't have the money. 2. Why? Because the rent is high. 3. Why? Because I live in a nice area. 4. Why? Because I like living there. 5. Why? Because the neighborhood has nice people, good shops and restaurants, and makes me feel safe. We've now deconstructed one large challenge into its smaller components, each of which we can target separately. More importantly, in this example, we also surface the underlying values being threatened by the situation. Often when deconstructing a challenge, you'll discover what's truly at stake. In this case, it's not really about the rent. It's about losing the feeling of pleasure and safety. These are two important data points that can be used to inform your plan of attack. Plan of attack. With our list of reasons clearly laid out, the next step is to figure out what our options are. Naturally, this is done by creating another list. You can do this on the facing page of your I can't pay rent collection. If the issue is that you don't have the money, you can start listing ways you could tackle that specific issue. A few that come to mind are 1. Ask for a raise. 2. Look for a better paying job. 3. Get a roommate. 4. Move to a different neighborhood where the cost of living is lower. 5. Take continuing education classes to increase your value. Now we're making some progress. Each entry is a path forward. Now, with your options clearly laid out before you, pick the one that excites you the most, the one that shines forth. Let's say you chose, take continuing education classes to increase your value. That's your goal. Flip to the next blank spread and create a subcollection dedicated to this goal. With your goal set up, break it down into actionable steps like research fields of interest, find different schools offering classes, sign up for a class, and so on. This is your plan of attack. Each task you complete is a successful blow landed in the battle with your dragon. Life is full of dragons. The longer they live, the bigger they become, feeding off our misfortunes, resentments, and sense of helplessness. Stare them down. Look directly into their big, terrible eyes. There you will see your own reflection. Our challenges are mirrors, exposing our vulnerabilities, insecurities, weaknesses, and fears. As hard as it may be, don't turn away. See them. Examine them. Meet your fears with curiosity, and you will discover a way forward. It's entirely possible that your courage will be rewarded with opportunities for personal or professional growth that would have been hidden from you otherwise. In my case, my dragon was my job. It terrified me. It embodied all the things I had naively sworn never to subject myself to. A dead-end job that was not creative in any meaningful way. But I had to pay my bills, so I took it. I was so caught up in my own misery that I forgot a simple truth. As long as our hearts are beating, there is always opportunity. Finally, after another particularly savage verbal abuse session from my boss, I'd had enough. I was tired of being a victim, not only to her, but also to my lesser qualities. I was tired of being the honored and only guest at my personal pity party, tired of the feeling of helplessness. These miseries were entirely my own doing, as if enduring this terrible situation made me some kind of noble martyr. It was ridiculous and immature. I was just trying to ignore the fact that the only solution would have to come from me and no one else. It started with setting a goal, get a new job. When I realized that that wasn't going to happen because I didn't have anything to show for myself, I simply set a new goal, learn to build websites. That's when I started using my dragon, my job, against itself. My meager salary paid for classes. The abuse and meaninglessness of my position motivated me to drag myself to night school. As hard as it was, each class felt like a little victory in my battle. Finally, I was able to land my killing blow. Not with a sword, but with a terse letter of resignation printed on paper warped by the flood. Now when things are not going my way, or when I need to work on something that doesn't inspire me to do backflips, I think back to my Tiamat. I look around and see all the things I was able to make from that experience. It forced me to learn how to code, which led to a fulfilling career as a digital product designer, which provided the hands-on education I needed to launch BulletJournal.com, which ultimately resulted in the privilege to write this book and share the Bullet Journal with you. Inertia. I shall either find a way or make one. Hannibal Barca. In the chapter on goals, we talked about breaking down major challenges into smaller, more manageable sprints. What happens if you get stuck along the way? Maybe you're hung up on a problem, or you've lost motivation, or you're having a hard time finding a way forward on a project, goal, or in a relationship. Whatever the reason may be, you're left feeling frustrated by the sense of inertia. What to do? Here are two techniques I found very useful in getting back some traction. In practice, rubber ducking. A friend who was a successful small business owner was looking to open another location. She applied for a loan to finance the build-out of the new space. Though she already ran three profitable branches, the bank turned down her request. Understandably upset, she called her accountant and started walking him through the problem. Piece by piece, she began articulating what she was trying to accomplish. As she did so, she began to realize that her goal wasn't so much about opening this specific location as it was about growing her business. She opted to create five small pop-up shops to test which location would bring in the most business. This she could afford without any outside support. She figured out a solution by explaining the problem. This process is known as rubber ducking, which originates from the book The Pragmatic Programmer by Andrew Hunt and David Thomas. The authors tell the story of a developer who solves problems in their code by explaining them line by line to a rubber duck. Yes, I'm talking about the small yellow bath toy. We're apt to lose our objectivity when we're spinning our wheels. By explaining a problem in detail to someone or something else, we're forced to change our perspective, viewing it from above, so to speak, and not from the depths of whatever mental hole we've dug ourselves into. If no one's around to listen, you can sit down with your bullet journal and write a letter to Dear Duck, or some other benign, trusted, or accepting entity. Tell them about your problem, what's not working, why it isn't working, what you've tried, what you have not tried, what you want to have happen. The important part is getting out of your head. Craft your explanation with care and patience. Do so with the understanding that this entity may not have all the information that you do. Good communication bridges the gap between information and understanding. In the process of carefully communicating the problem, you may help yourself figure out a solution. And if a letter to your rubber duck, padded panda, stupid stapler, or God forbid Chad doesn't do the trick, we can try something else. Break sprints. If you've been following along in sequence, at this point you should have a goals collection set up. This collection can serve as a powerful inspirational resource when you're feeling stuck or unmotivated. I know. I had mentioned earlier not to revisit your goals collection until you're done with the ones you're working on, but this is an emergency. When you're really stuck or out of ideas, it usually means that you've lost perspective. You may no longer be able to see a way forward because you're too close to the subject. To regain some perspective, it can help to temporarily disengage your mind by focusing on something else. To that end, we'll create what I like to call a break sprint. Much like the sprints we covered earlier in this audio program, break sprints are self-contained micro-projects. They're designed for the sole purpose of helping your mind get unstuck. A break sprint can be set up in your bullet journal the same way as a standard sprint, but it follows a subtly different set of rules. 1. It should take 2 weeks or less to complete. You need a break, but you don't want to lose the thread of your main project. 2. It should be unrelated to the project/problem that's troubling you. You and your main project need space. You're not breaking up, but you're taking some much-needed me time. 3. Very critically, it needs to have a defined end and a clear beginning and middle too. When we feel stuck, our sense of inertia drains our motivation. One goal of your break sprint is to give you the satisfaction of crossing off the final task, of feeling the sense of accomplishment and closure. Reminding yourself what that feels like can quickly refuel your drive. Take that online class, write that article, organize your digital photo gallery, KonMari your closet, volunteer with your colleagues. It's entirely up to you. Just make sure it's something you're curious about. By the end of your break sprint, you'll have been exposed to something new. You'll have used your mind in a different way, to have thoughts that you would not have had otherwise. Every new experience helps us grow and grants us new perspective. You'll be ever so slightly different than you were the last time you tried to tackle the challenge that had you feeling stuck. And that can make all the difference. Imperfection. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Leonard Cohen. The holiday festivities had long passed, leaving the usually crowded New York streets empty. It was as though the city had gone into mass hibernation, bracing itself against the mirthless stretch of winter ahead. My then partner and I had been going through a rough patch, so I decided to plan a romantic stay-at-home date night for us. I tracked down that bottle of wine we enjoyed at our favorite place that had since been shuttered. On the menu was handmade sweet potato gnocchi. I'd never made it before, but I knew she loved it. How hard could it be? Turns out really hard. Naturally, everything went comically wrong from the get-go, and I had to start over from scratch, a few times. I spent hours baffled by the recipe, my face as contorted as the potatoes. As the hours passed, I grew increasingly irritable and frantic. The image of her coming home to a perfectly dressed table, flickering candles, with music softly playing in the background, was going up in smoke. By the skin of my teeth, I got it done. She walked in, saw the table, dropped all her bags, and jumped into my arms, burying her cold face in my chest. When she looked up at me, her huge smile faded a little, and she asked me what was wrong. "Nothing," I replied sullenly, dusting the flour off my pants. We sat down, and she went on about how amazing everything was. But I was too busy brooding over all the mistakes I had made preparing the meal. This was undercooked. That was too cold. I was comparing what was with what I had hoped would be, that perfect image in my mind. The only thing I failed to see was how enchanted she was by the gesture, and how that joy slowly drained as I kept harping on about what I could have done better. I managed to spoil the most important ingredient in that dinner, our time together, all because I wanted everything to be perfect. Perfection is an unnatural and damaging concept. I say unnatural because, as far as I'm able to tell, there's not a single thing in the physical world, when examined closely enough, that fully adheres to our own definition of perfection, that which is faultless and can't be improved upon. Even our standards of measurement don't comply. For example, the international prototype of the kilogram, more affectionately known as le grand cœur, it was created in France, was the physical object that set the standard of one of the most widely used measurements of weight in the world. Duplicates were shipped around the globe for other countries to use as their standard. It turned out that over time, these perfect objects had individually changed in mass. For a standard of weight, that's a critical problem. After all, a perfect absolute should not be able to change. That's why these days such standards are expressed in terms of equations and concepts. Now you may fire back and say, what about me getting 100% on my math test? That's a perfect score. Sure, your answers may have been correct, but were the questions? What was the point of the test? Was it a perfect way of assessing your ability? No, tests are approximations at best. There are plenty of people who test well yet perform poorly. There are even more who test poorly but perform well. One could argue that perfection only exists in the intangible concepts, theories, and beliefs used to define the ideal, the permanent, and the divine. Why am I belaboring this point? Because the idea of perfection all too often sabotages our ability to become who we have the potential to be. We're marvelous yet imperfect creatures. And few things make this as clear as inventing unattainable standards to hold ourselves to. So our aspirations often wither on the vine because of our inability to live up to the misguided ideals we hold for our bodies, our minds, our achievements, and our relationships. Failing to be perfect is one of our biggest sources of self-loathing. It's intentionality gone bad. Where we spend time and energy undoing our progress, we tear up our plans, recommit to counterproductive behaviors, and empower our inner critic. The big misconception is that the alternative to perfection is failure. Mercifully, life isn't binary. It exists on a spectrum. On one side, we have the unattainable, perfection. On the opposite side, we have the unavoidable, chaos. All of the beauty that exists in the world hangs in the balance. In Japan, there is the term wabi-sabi. Wabi-sabi posits that the beauty of an object is found in its imperfection. In direct contrast to the Western perspective, which tends to conflate perfection with beauty, wabi-sabi celebrates transience, individuality, and the flawed nature of a thing. These are the qualities that make it unique, genuine, and beautiful. The cracks in the pot, the warp in the wood, the leaves on the stone, the spatter of the ink. It mirrors the Buddhist philosophies, in which wisdom comes from making peace with our fallible natures. Embracing our imperfection puts the emphasis back where it should be, continual improvement. This mindset turns mistakes from landmines into street signs, pointing us towards where we need to go. By celebrating transience, the universal changing nature of all things, wabi-sabi champions a forgiving path with limitless opportunities to progress. In practice, practicing imperfection. Now you may be thinking, I'm all too aware of how human I am. I don't need any more practice in imperfection. It's not about making mistakes on purpose. It's about reframing your response to them. In meditation, the goal, so far as there can be one, is to be present. By disentangling ourselves from our thoughts, we can view them objectively. Easier said than done. Even the most experienced practitioners are consumed by their thoughts from time to time. The key is realizing that you're stuck in a thought and pulling yourself back out of it. More so, it's to perceive the wanderings of your mind not as a mistake, but as an opportunity. Each time you come back into the present, you ever so slightly strengthen your ability to focus. In this way, you begin to embrace a flaw with curiosity instead of judgment. Are you the type of person who strives to have a perfect notebook? Maybe you don't have great handwriting, or you lack the artistic ability to make your notebook pretty. Does that matter? Only if you wanted to. You could look at your notebook as the evidence of your imperfections, or you could look at it as a testament to your courage. Those crooked lines and rough letters paint a picture of someone striving to learn and make a positive change in their life. It may not be perfect, but it's unquestionably beautiful. Do you abandon notebooks when you make a mistake or get a false start? If so, try creating an imperfection collection. Somewhere in your notebook, dedicate a space where you just let go. Maybe start by writing your name with your non-dominant hand. Scribble, doodle, whatever you like. Do what you fear would make your notebook feel flawed. Does it make your bullet journal any less valuable? No. One could argue that now it's one of a kind. Whenever you find yourself obsessing over getting every little thing perfect, remind yourself it's just a tool. It's what you're building that counts. By accepting that we can't be perfect and that we will fail, we can get back to work. Good change. Isn't self-improvement or personal development striving for perfection? It depends on the goal you set. Rather than aiming for perfection or striving to be better than others, find opportunities to continually improve yourself. As W.L. Sheldon purportedly wrote, "There is nothing noble in being superior to your fellow man. True nobility is being superior to your former self." To fully appreciate wabi-sabi as a model for personal growth, it helps to look a little closer at the culture it originated in. The Japanese have a long history of elevating craftsmanship to mystifying levels, be it carpentry, metalsmithing, even product packaging. Great emphasis was placed on mastery rather than on perfection. Mastery, unlike perfection, embraces both transience and imperfection because it is a process, a state of being, not an end goal. It is the continued result of improvement and learning. Author Malcolm Gladwell citing Daniel Levitin, famously described the 10,000-hour rule, which states that 10,000 hours of deliberate practice is required to become world-class at anything. Japanese apprenticeships could span a lifetime. Mastery replaces the notion of perfection with aspiring to better ourselves through dedication and practice. When it comes to skill, there can be no fixed point. Even the greatest masters remain avid students. Their skill, like our own, develops over time. They all started somewhere, and chances are their first efforts were just as clumsy as any of ours would be. Every day, ask yourself small questions. Figure out some way in which you can improve. Then format that answer as a task or goal and log it in your bullet journal. Each task completed is experience gained. Keep track of your progress. This way you'll be more likely to actually take action. Every action is a step up from where you were. It doesn't matter how small the steps are or if you stumble along the way. What matters is that you continue to step up. Part 4, The Art, where form meets function. I recently took a terrible capoeira class. For those unfamiliar with the term, capoeira is a martial art invented by Brazilian slaves that cloaked its martial intent behind dance-like movements that mingle acrobatics, contortionism, sing-along, and the tightly wound intensity of tango. When playing, two capoeiristas fluidly whirl around each other's bodies, often deploying gravity-defying handstands and flips. The modern breakdancers and urban runners whose videos you see on YouTube liberally appropriate movements from capoeira. In short, it's an impressive and bewildering thing to behold, and more than a little mind and body bending to do. I sloshed my way through the tropical downpour to get to the leaky jungle hangar where the class was being held. Only four of us washed up in the rain. Yours truly, one other student, and two very stone capoeira teachers. They mumbled through some introduction and asked us if we had any experience. My fellow student admitted that she'd never heard of capoeira before that morning. The not-so-dynamic duo looked at each other uncertainly and then started sluggishly demonstrating seemingly random movements. My fellow student and I awkwardly stood there, uncertain what we were supposed to do. When it finally dawned on the instructors to, you know, instruct, they asked us to imitate their movements. Because they had failed to provide us with any context, these movements felt, well, ridiculous. To the untrained eye, a lot of these basic forms look like the movements of an enthusiastic drunk looking for their dropped keys. Well, at least that's what I look like. It wasn't until the end of class, when the teachers finally played with each other, linking all the movements into a cohesive and beautiful sequence, that the pieces finally, literally came together. It turned out we had learned a lot in the 2 hours we were there, but we didn't realize it without putting all the pieces into play. Into context. We've covered a lot of ground so far in this book, and there are a lot of pieces whirling around. You may be feeling a little bit like I did in capoeira class, staring at something you don't quite know what to make of. So I want to make sure that, unlike them, I contextualize how the system and the practice come together. You may have heard the saying before, give a man a fish, and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, and you feed him for a lifetime. In the bullet journal method, the system is the rod. The practice provides the line and the lure. They're two separate parts that can only be fully appreciated when you see them come together. A powerful way of experiencing this and deepening your understanding is by learning how to customize and design your own collections. Designing your own collections shows you how to make Bujo your own. In the process, you put into practice all of the elements we've covered in this audio program so far. It's part organization, part soul-searching, part dream-weaving. These ingredients, when combined mindfully, will allow you to continuously reshape your bullet journal into a tool that can help you do far more than just order your chaos. It's here where we can truly leverage the flexibility of this methodology to chart a path toward what shines forth with intention. One thing that keeps bringing me back to the bullet journal, what allows it to remain relevant after all these years, is how it continues to adapt to my changing needs. your bullet journal can become whatever you need it to be. Figuring out what you need it to be, how it can best serve you, is part of the practice, and it will change over time. In this part of the audio program, we'll examine how to go about doing that by working on a project that requires us to consider different kinds of elements. It will allow us to explore different ways of using the bullet journal to tackle challenges, deconstruct them, and design custom layouts or templates that will help us organize a plan of action. Rather than being prescriptive, these chapters serve to highlight considerations that I hope you will find useful as you set out to make bullet journal your own. Caveat. As exciting as it can be to dive into customization, if you're new to bullet journaling, I suggest holding off on implementing your own more complex collections until you're comfortable using what you've learned in parts 2 and 3. I recommend at least 2 to 3 months of basic bullet journaling before you start experimenting with your collections. It's important that you feel comfortable with the day-to-day features of the methodology before you start augmenting it. If you're just getting started, this section is intended to provide a glimpse of how you'll be able to greatly extend the functionality of your bullet journal when you're ready. Every tool and technique that I've introduced so far serves a purpose both on its own and as part of a whole. The bullet journal method is a productivity ecosystem of different techniques and philosophies. Each helps the rest flourish. Before you introduce a new species, I urge you to better understand the local population. Once you do, you'll improve your chances of customizing your bullet journal practice so that it will bear fruit. Key concepts. Extend your bujo with custom collections. Your bullet journal can become anything you need it to be. Figuring out what you need it to be is part of the practice. A simple guideline is custom collections should serve a purpose. Make sure that the collections you maintain are adding value to your life. Productivity is about carefully investing your time. If you find yourself struggling, define your motivations. Before you figure out how to best do something, clarify why you're doing it in the first place. Study your effort. Each collection is an attempt to learn. It's important to study your collections, both the ones that worked as well as the ones that didn't, to see what you can take for the next round. Less, but better. Function over form. Your notebook does not have to be beautiful to be valuable. Design should always serve a purpose. If it also happens to be beautiful, great, as long as it does not get in the way. Future-proof your design. Your notebooks tell the story of your life. Make sure your designs make that story easy to follow, both today and years from now. Community. One of the most valuable resources of the bullet journal is its community. It's contributed countless examples and applications. If you're stuck or need inspiration, search your favorite social network for #bulletjournal or #bujo. You can find a visual guide to all these key concepts in the bonus PDF. Custom collections. Content precedes design. Design in the absence of content is not design, it's decoration. Jeffrey Zeldman. The bullet journal's 4 core collections, index, future log, monthly log, and daily log, will serve you well in most cases. That said, bullet journal embraces the fact that one size does not fit all. What if you need to keep track of something in a way that's not presented in this audio program? This is where custom collections come in. A custom collection is designed to serve a specific need. It can be as simple as a shopping list or as complicated as a long-term project. Creating custom collections is a creative, enjoyable, and rewarding aspect of bullet journaling because you're empowering yourself to solve your own challenges. Whereas the daily log is designed as a catch-all, custom collections should serve a specific purpose. Avoid being an information hoarder. I've been guilty of this myself, creating collections to track the TV shows I've watched, restaurants I've patronized, and other minutiae. I call these junk drawer collections. There's nothing wrong with tracking what you're doing in a collection, as long as you plan to do something constructive with the information. An aspiring filmmaker might want to track the films she's seen as part of her education. Am I saturating myself with thrillers and not studying comedy? Someone who continually falls off the exercise wagon might track workout data and fitness milestones as a way to monitor and encourage continued progress, or spot trends where he falters. Holidays? Those monthly poker nights? After yet another blind date gone bad? Junk drawer collections, in contrast, have limited longevity because they don't provide insight. If there's nothing to be learned from the information in a collection, it provides little value, and chances are you'll lack the incentive needed to maintain it. Don't waste your time tending collections that won't add value to your life. Three key sources for custom collections. Number one, goals. Goals are important because they should hold the promise of meaning, providing direction and purpose. They also tend to be complex, involving a lot of moving parts. Custom collections can help us deconstruct a goal into its elements so we can tackle them one at a time. Number two, challenges. Is there some part of your life that's consistently making you feel angry, anxious, overwhelmed, or self-critical? Once you've figured out what the challenge is, creating a custom collection tailored to address said challenge can prove very useful. It provides a dedicated space that helps you gather and clarify your thoughts so that you can focus on developing a solution and tracking your progress. Number three, tasks. Many collections begin their life posing as simple tasks, like plan vacation. During the course of your daily reflections, you may identify tasks harboring a warren of other tasks. The plan vacation task, for example, has many moving parts. Left as a singular action item, it will feel overwhelming, which puts it at risk of becoming an object of procrastination and a source of anxiety. Planning a vacation should be cause for excitement, not angst. So let's choose that for our custom collection project. Quick side note. Speaking of planning vacations, studies suggest that looking forward to fun events we plan, like trips, can function as an effective method to elevate our mood and sense of well-being. It's not the trip so much as the anticipation leading up to the trip that can prove both motivational and uplifting. This can be especially helpful when we're working our way through an otherwise challenging time. Through planning, we're setting a course for what shines forth and basking in the glow as we make our way there. First steps. To begin this project, let's start by creating our first collection. So we flip to our next blank spread and add the project topic, Hawaii vacation. That sounds like a lovely alternative to Brooklyn, which, as I wrote this, was being blanketed by snow by yet another whopping nor'easter, on the first day of spring, no less. Brainstorm. I like to kick off every project in my notebook by using the first pages of my collection for brainstorming. These pages are dedicated to capturing initial thoughts, no matter what form they take, be they single words, images, mind maps, etc. This spread is here for you to unload your ideas, get excited, and see what you can shake loose through free association. But sometimes we're so welded to our day-to-day, both in our doing and in our thinking, that this kind of blue-skying can actually be daunting, making it hard to know where to begin. If that's you, keep listening. Examine your motivations. When creating a collection for a project, be it writing a book, redoing the basement, or planning a vacation, a good place to start is by examining our motivation. Why are we taking on this project? What need does it address? To have more quality family time? To relax and refresh through surfing and or forest bathing? Whatever it is, it's okay. We're asking just to get the wheels turning so we can unearth the underlying cause of our motivation. Why is getting at the underlying cause so important? Motivation doesn't exist in a vacuum. It results from our pain, frustration, or desire. Whatever the case may be, we need to surface it before we can assure that our efforts aren't misdirected. By identifying our true motivations, we increase the potential impact of our actions. In other words, Understanding why you feel compelled to do something will help you better define how to do something. As noted earlier, our first opportunity to clarify our intention is when we pause to consider a topic name that captures the essence of what this project is about. Sometimes, though, we need a little more detail than that. In times like these, it can help to write out a brief mission statement to define why we're doing something, what we hope to get out of the experience, and how we will go about doing it. You can even use this script if it proves helpful. I want to what so that I can why by how. So in this case, the mission statement could be, I want to go on vacation so that I can relax by not being in the office. Now, while there's nothing wrong with this mission statement, digging a little deeper could help you uncover how this trip could connect with something meaningful to you. After all, you don't need to travel to be out of the office. What is it about this trip that really excites you? We can use the five whys to help us here. 1. Why do you want to go on vacation? To relax. 2. Why? Because work is stressing me out and depressing me. 3. Why? Because it's the same thing day in, day out, and it makes me feel lonely. 4. Why? Because my life is confined to my cubicle and my couch, and I don't get to see the people I care about. 5. Why? Because I don't take time for those things. We've now identified various pain points that we can begin to tackle. Let's start by highlighting some key themes that have surfaced: confinement, boredom, depression, loneliness, and guilt. These are the likely sources of your motivation. The goal for this vacation would then be to alleviate those pain points by experiencing their opposites: freedom, excitement, joy, connection, and pride. Let's rephrase our mission statement to address these desires. I want to go on vacation so that I can remind myself what I'm working for, pride, by spending quality time with people I care about, connection, while we have fun, joy, exploring a tropical place together, freedom and excitement. This simple exercise not only helped us figure out our priorities for our trip, but also gave us some food for thought that we can address later on when we're calm and tan. Also, keep in mind that this technique can be applied to any project of your choosing. For example, I want to write a book so that I can teach people how to have more agency over their life by sharing the knowledge I found valuable for living intentionally. Or, I want to go to nursing school so that I can help people by learning how to treat illness and suffering. Feel free to create your own script. Just make sure it helps you dig into your motivation and expose what's most important to you about your venture. Later, when you're in the thick of the process, your mission statement can help remind you of what your priorities are, functioning as a compass if and when you need it. Writing down this mission statement is also a great way to wake the page. That's the term I use to describe the act of marking the page for the first time. It's the moment when thought transcends the distance between our inner and outer world, and we breathe life into our ideas. Beginning can be the hardest part. What better way to wake the page than by stating what you want? Don't overthink it. Just write down what you feel. It's not a contract. It's just a benevolent way to nudge yourself over the starting line. Design. Designer knows he's achieved perfection not when there's nothing left to add, but when there's nothing left to take away. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. If you search for bullet journal or bujo online, you may have seen the elaborately illustrated interpretations people have created. They're gorgeous, motivating to some, but intimidating to many others. People assume they can't bullet journal because they're not artists or because their handwriting is too sloppy. Allow me to lay those concerns to rest. The only thing that matters in bujo is the content, not the presentation. If you can elevate both, then my hat's off to you. But the only artistic skill required is the ability to draw straightish lines. If you can manage that, then you'll be fine. As bullet journalist Timothy Collinson says, I must have the plainest, most minimal style of bullet journaling you could imagine, as I'm no artist and calligraphy is a dream beyond the horizon. But I can honestly say it's been life-changing. The goal when designing our collections is to maximize their functionality, legibility, and sustainability. In this chapter, I want to delve into each and share some considerations that may prove helpful when you set out to design your